Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 956, The National Front and French Deep Politics, part one. This is being recorded on April 27th of the year 2017. This past weekend was the first round of the French presidential election. There is going to be a runoff election, and one of the major factors in the results of Sunday's preliminary vote was the success of the National Front of Marine Le Pen. Donald Trump was expressing sentiments relatively sympathetic to Marine Le Pen. He voiced his opinion that the terror incident that happened shortly before the election would swing the election for Marine Le Pen, who like Donald Trump, has been minting valuable political currency with an anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim political theme. She also, Marine Le Pen, that is, was spotted in January of this year at Trump Tower, but she reportedly did not meet with Donald Trump. Before we get to the National Front and its fascist character and heritage, we're going to note that Steve Bannon, one of Donald Trump's top advisors, is no stranger to the world of French fascism. In fact, one of the many fascist influences upon Steve Bannon is a French fascist named Charles Maurras. We're going to excerpt For the Record program number 951, dealing first with the Bannon-Maurras connection and then with some of the history of the rise of fascism in France due to the efforts of a fifth column in France, of which Charles Maurras was part. Yet another influence on Stephen Bannon is a French fascist named Charles, that's C-H-A-R-L-E-S, like the English Charles, Maurras, M-A-U-R-R-A-S. Article about him from Mother Jones of March 16th of 2017, article by Pema, P-E-M as in Mary A, Levy, capital L-E-V-Y. Stephen Bannon is a fan of a French philosopher who was an anti-Semite and a Nazi supporter, it reads in part. Stephen Bannon, Donald Trump's chief strategist, recently spoke approvingly of the ideas of an anti-Semitic French intellectual who was sentenced to life in prison for cooperating with the Nazis during World War II. In an article on Bannon's interactions with European right-wing nationalists who want to break apart the European Union, Politico reported last week that Bannon has, quote, expressed admiration for the reactionary French philosopher Charles Maurras, according to French media reports confirmed by Politico. Recent articles in French media claim Bannon favorably cited Maurras to a French diplomat, skipping down. But Maurras was more than a nationalist. He was an infamous anti-Semite whose anti-Jewish views were central to his outlook. From 1908 to 1944, Maurras edited the anti-Semitic paper L'Action Française, the organ of an eponymous movement that was anti-democratic and pro-monarchy. The movement was born out of the Dreyfus Affair, an international controversy in which an innocent Jewish soldier was convicted in 1894 of passing secrets to the Germans, parenthetically that during the Franco-Prussian War of 1870, a crime for which he was later exonerated. The movement's, quote, founding prejudice, unquote, was that Dreyfus was in fact guilty and that those who supported him were undermining France. According to Frederick Brown's The Embrace of Unreason, France, 1914 to 1940. Maurras spent years writing anti-Semitic articles. He referred to the French government known as the Third Republic as the Jew state, the Masonic state, the immigrant state, unquote. In 1936, Morales served 8 months in prison for inciting the attempted assassination of Jewish politician Léon Blum, L-E-O-N-B-L-U-M, and other French officials. According to Carmen Khalil's Bad Faith, A Forgotten History of Family, Fatherland, and Vichy France, Morales penned numerous articles calling for Blum to be lynched, or Blum to be lynched, and shot in the back, and have his throat slit. Parenthetically, Léon Blum was actually, for a short time, the head of the Social Front, which was in the governing seat of France for a short period of time. It was the focal point of various coup attempts, such as the Cagoulard coup that we have discussed in a number of different programs. Continuing with the article, Morales blamed World War II on the Jews, faulting them for the German occupation of France. Quote, the barbarous occupation of 1940 would not have taken place without the Jews of 1939, without their filthy war, the war they undertook, and they declared. Our occupiers were introduced by them. It was the Jews who launched us into catastrophe, he wrote, according to a 2001 article by Khalil in the New Statesman. Khalil, by the way, is C-A-L-L-I-L. Khalil also noted that Morales newspaper supported the Nazis and, quote, named names, hunted down enemies, and called for hostages, résistants, Jews, and Gaullists to be shot, unquote. In his political column during the war, Morales wrote that, quote, if the death penalty is not sufficient to put a stop to the Gaullists, members of their families should be seized as hostages and executed, unquote. At the end of the war, Morales was sentenced to life in prison for complicity with the Nazis. He reportedly cited his conviction, quote, Dreyfus's revenge, unquote. Due to his failing health, he was released from prison shortly before his death in 1952. According to Politico, Bannon approvingly cited Morales' distinction between what the French philosopher called the real country of the people and the legal country, unquote, led by government officials. Morales put Jews in the latter category, according to Brown, and referred to all Jews as foreigners. This further fascist influence on Stephen Bannon, Charles Morales, was head of l'Action Française and a doctrinaire anti-Semite, and also a Nazi collaborator. What is not really, it exists in the background of the discussion, but that is the powerful pro-German, pro-Nazi fascist fifth column that existed in France. There had been powerful underground fascist movements in France, such as the aforementioned Cagoulard or Hooded Ones, the Croix de Feu or Cross of Fire, and they had a number of different publications toward which they gravitated, such as L'Action Française. This fifth column, in turn, was a administrative and street-level manifestation of a profound international corporate link between French steelmakers and ironmakers and some of the German steel and ironmakers and the allied coal interests in the Saar region of Germany. The French Comité de Forge and many of the Saar industrialists and and steelmakers in Germany, were allied with their French counterparts through various international cartel agreements, and ultimately that manifested as not only an economic fifth column, but a political fifth column as well.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at SpitfireList.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
In For the Record 372 from the fall of 2002, we discussed not only the corporate fifth column in France, its alignment with many of the German industrialists and financiers who helped to back the armies that marched into France, but how the French cartel partners of the German coal and steel producers ultimately helped to get their German compatriots off of any legal hook for any of the things that they had done. After discussing that economic fifth column and comparing what the results of that were, and discussing the comparison between the economic fifth column in France prior to and during World War II, and the powerful corporate and economic alliances between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia that was among the factors that eclipsed the reality of the September 11th attacks. We discussed the fifth column movement in France, how it torpedoed the German, the French military resistance toward the Germans, and the role of the officers in the German military, or the French military, I should say, who referenced people like Charles Marat and the publications like L'Action Française. So from the fall of 2002, here is an excerpt of For the Record 372. There is a brief misstatement in which I identified this as 371. So again, from For the Record 372, the fall of 2002.
We're going to take a look now at a book called Triumph of Treason. This was authored by Pierre Cot, last name C-O-T, who was the French Minister of Aviation under Léon Blum's Social Front for the French government. Triumph of Treason by Pierre Cot was published by Ziff Davis Publishing Company and copyright 1944. So this book was published before the end of World War II. Now, in this book, Pierre Cot, who again was the French Minister of Aviation and who struggled against some of the forces of French reaction to modernize the French Air Force and to put the French military on a competitive basis with the Nazis, unfortunately, as we looked at in Miscellaneous Archive Show M60, available from Spitfire, many of the more powerful interests in France not only were connected to some of their German counterparts, and again, we took a look at the De Wendels' running of interference for the German Rockling family in both World Wars. They helped to spare Rockling interests in World War I while the two countries were at war, and then the Rocklings got key contracts to help make the Maginot Line. What we're going to talk about here, courtesy of Pierre Cot and Triumph of Treason, is the rapid capitulation of the French military in World War II. This due to the activities in part of a powerful fascist fifth column in France. And I believe that there is a similar fifth column in the United States, marrying American fascist elements to Islamo-fascist elements, and I believe in turn the structural relationship between American oil companies and Saudi Arabia is in some ways analogous to the relationship between the French heavy industrialists and their counterparts in Germany. That relationship translated into the onto the battlefield as follows. Again, Pierre Cot writing in Triumph of Treason from 1944. Talking about the condemning of the Social Front of Léon Blum for the rapid collapse of the French army, and this condemning being done by the very fascist elements that had subverted the French army, Pierre Cot writes as follows. First of all, it was necessary to preserve the honor of the army, unquote. General Weygand thundered these words like a command. He was one of the French generals who would help to deliver the French to the Germans. Speaking of Weygand, he used unconsciously the same terms that leaders of the French army had invoked during the Dreyfus affair to prevent public opinion from discovering their criminal mistakes. Preserve the honor of the army to French military men is to secure by every means, including those outlawed by moral law and the penal code, the defense of the military establishment. This again against charges of having basically blown it in the war against the Germans in World War II. Continuing. The question of the responsibility of military leaders in the military defeat of France either had to be evaded or posed in distorted terms. To preserve the honor of the army, unquote, the scapegoats of the defeat had to be chosen from among the political personnel of the Third Republic. Again, that was the Blum government of which Coe was part. Continuing. In truth, at the end of June 1940, the question of who was responsible was in everyone's mind. In the 2 weeks preceding the armistice, I was in touch with the crowd of refugees that slowly and painfully followed the road southward. In the offices of the prefects, in the town halls, restaurants, and relief centers, I listened to many conversations, received many confidences, heard many opinions. Opinions differed on governmental policy, but all agreed in denouncing the blunders of the French general staff. The country was unanimous not against Blum, Daladier, or even against Laval, Pierre-Étienne Flandin, Georges Bonnet, or Jacques Doriot, but against the generals who had been incapable of understanding the conditions of modern warfare and who were guilty of not knowing the rudiments of their profession. Quote, just as before 1914 they had prepared for the war of 1870, the people said. Before 1939, they prepared for the war of 1914, unquote. And again, I believe there were bureaucratic blunders of the most profound sort, which obviously were evident in the failure to prevent September 11th. I also believe that, as was the case in France, there was active subversion of the investigation into bin Laden and the possibility that the attacks could have been prevented by a fascist fifth column. Some of the undermining of the anti bin Laden effort was due to the economic efforts within the context of the structural relationship, but within the context of that structural relationship, domestic and European and Islamo-fascist elements, I believe, are at work to subvert and destroy the United States. Continuing. The severest condemnation of the French general staff came from the soldiers themselves. Lost on the roads in pursuit of dispersed divisions and phantom regiments, thrown together with the refugees whose uncertainties and anxieties they shared, the men in uniform cursed the conduct of their own leaders. They repeated that they had never been schooled in the techniques of modern warfare, especially in the combined use of tanks and aviation, and they were amazed at the ineptness of their own commanders in the battles of May and June. They asked why the Meuse and Seine bridges had not been blown up before the arrival of German motorized columns, why Paris had not been defended street by street as the Spanish Republicans had defended Madrid and as the Russians were to defend Stalingrad. And they wanted to know why more than half of the tanks and airplanes had been left in the rear, in Orléans, Toulouse, Lyon, North Africa, instead of being massed for a counterattack that might have changed everything on the battlefield. They knew that the depot were bursting with the cannon, airplanes, and equipment they had needed. One began to hear quoted the disturbing remarks with which General Weygand had tried to persuade the cabinet to ask for an armistice, that he needed his tanks to master the revolutionary elements at home if it should become necessary. That is to say, the commander-in-chief of the French army preferred fighting French workers to throwing all of his forces against the French troops. The soldiers praised the bravery of certain leaders, Giraud, Lestien, de Gaulle, Lucien, Delattre de Tassigny, and many others, but they declared that most of the officers had been the first to flee. Quote, they left in automobiles and we left on foot, they said, talking about those officers, faithful followers of L'Action Française, Je suis partout, Gringoire, and the other French fascist newspapers which had said in various forms during the winter that this was a democratic war and consequently did not interest them. And speaking again about the rage against the generals in France, by June of 1940, Not one man, unless he were directly involved, would have defended the general staff. The most indulgent spoke of incompetence, the most severe of betrayal, and the latter were in the majority. Moreover, available information about war prisoners indicated that these unfortunates were still more bitter against their leaders than were their comrades in France. Their anger was legitimate. It was inexplicable, after all, that the general staff, after deciding to abandon Paris and thus opening the east to the Germans, had not ordered the troops which occupied the Maginot Line to fall back toward the south. More than 1 million men, the best of the French army, were caught in the German trap, a disaster which could have been prevented by an order from General Weygand. And again, it was the opinion of many that, quite simply, the French general staff, in line with the interests of elements like the de Vendels and the Comité de Forges, were really much more enamored of Hitler than of their own countrymen, whose interests they, if not actively opposed, whose potential power they feared. After the Vichy fascist collaborationist government was set up in France on behalf of elements like the de Vendels and promptly dropping the 40-year sentence against the Roquelings, as we looked at in Side 1, the blame for the defeat was deflected away from the fascist Fifth Column and onto the social front of Léon Blum. Continuing with Triumph of Treason, by its composition, the government of Vichy was representative not of the French people, but of the general staff. Its first cabinets were headed by Maréchal Pétain, the spiritual leader of the French army, the man who had played the most important part in the preparation of the war and in the formation of the general staff. And these cabinets were composed largely of members of the general staff, General Weygand, General Pujol, Admiral Darlin, General Hunsinger, General Bergeret, and Admiral Platon. As the French proverb says, the wolves do not eat each other, skipping down. To their astonishment, the French people saw Maréchal Pétain slowly fill the most important posts of authority in local, departmental, and central administrations with men who had taken part in the fascist Cagoulard plot of 1938, with those who had repeated the infamous refrain, rather Hitler than Léon Blum, and even with some of those who before or during the war had been arrested for treasonable domestic and foreign activities. The people were applying to the government the old proverb, tell me who your friends are, and I'll tell you who you are. They were alarmed to see Vichy employ for its most delicate missions Ferdinand de Brinon, Jean Montigny, Jean Goy, Jean Lucher, and Gaston Henri A., members of the Comité France-Allemagne, an organization which before the war had been inspired and financed by Otto Abetz, after 1940, Hitler's ambassador in Paris. They learned with fury that on the night of the armistice, when France was in mourning, Frenchmen and French women of the aristocracy, high finance, and industry had drunk at Bordeaux to the defeat which had rid them of the nightmare of democracy and of the popular front. The people understood that the Fifth Column in France, as in Spain, had opened the door to Hitler's agents, and they watched with awe the agents of the Fifth Column become masters of France, the France of Pétain, Weygand, and Laval. And still later, this fascist Fifth Column, which was to subvert France in the early stages of World War II, and which in turn was able to operate within some of the structural relationships between French heavy industry and German heavy industry. And again, I believe there is a similar an analogous Fifth Column at work in this country, in which domestic fascists, the heirs in some cases to some of the imports of the Crusade for Freedom, and Islamo-fascists associated not only with the power elite in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, but also with the power elite in the United States, as exemplified in the Talat Otman, Abdullah Baksh, George Bush connection, I believe a similar Fifth Column is subverting the United States today. And I think that in the event of another disastrous terrorist incident, we should consider very carefully what the future of the country is going to be and just how much we wish to tolerate from interests like Saudi Arabia. Yeah. Turning to discussion of the French Fifth Column in Triumph of Treason, again, this book was written in 1944. Pierre Coe writes, "The activity of the Fifth Column will not be considered by historians as a special phenomenon of French public life only, but as an integral part of fascism. The Fifth Column has appeared wherever fascism is trying to gain a foothold. It was at work in Spain, Austria, and Czechoslovakia before it turned up in France, and there are Fifth Columns in the United States, India, and Latin America. By Fifth Column, I do not mean only spies and licensed traitors. The Fifth Column includes all who, by accepting fascist doctrines or methods, become the conscious or unconscious accomplices of a foreign power. Treason and complicity have their degrees and nuances. The general staff of the Fifth Column consists principally of ambitious men who try to seize power by destroying or paralyzing the democratic system. The body of the Fifth Column is composed of people who think they are saving their country from the communist menace or British imperialism, and who do not even know in whose favor their actions are operating. Through hate of the Popular Front, good Frenchmen or men who consider themselves such served Hitler gratuitously by doing work to which they would never have consented had they been offered payment. Why? Because they detested the Republic and democracy more than they loved France. They accepted the idea of the defeat as a necessary evil which permitted them to rid France of the democratic system and to keep in power in the neighboring countries the fascist dictators whom they considered solely capable of maintaining any sort of order in Europe. They afterwards became unconscious collaborators of these very same dictators. They thought they were doing their duty in letting Hitler free France from the Judeo-Masonic influence and Europe from the communist peril. These people, who had never read Marx, considered the Marxist danger, unquote, more immediate than the Hitlerian danger. They preferred the risks of an entente with a victorious Hitler to the risks of a democratic victory that would cause the collapse of the fascist dictators in Europe. Considering Hitler in Germany, Mussolini in Italy, and Franco in Spain as knights of an anti-Bolshevist crusade, they became precursors and later partisans of collaboration with Hitler's new order, unquote. Skipping down in Triumph of Treason by Pierre Coe, enough evidence has been published already to prove that France was stabbed in the back by those who saw in Hitler the new Saint George who would slay the communist dragon. Again, I'm not suggesting this is a precise analogy, but I believe we have something similar in the United States, which is deathly afraid of democracy and which is actively working on behalf not only of an underground Reich, but which is using some of the structural relationships within the petroleum industry and Saudi Arabia to effect what ultimately will be either the destruction or subjugation of the United States. Continuing with Pierre Coe's discussion of the Fifth Column in France, when Pierre Lazareff, former editor-in-chief of Paris Soir, the French newspaper with the widest circulation, reports royalists as saying, "We need the defeat to wipe out the Republic," when Elie Bois, former editor of the Petit Parisien, the most influential political newspaper, reports great industrialists as admitting to him during the winter of 1939-1940 that a plot had been organized to replace the democratic regime by a government of authority, unquote, and that this plot presupposed a Nazi victory, we have every reason to accept their affirmations, which tally so perfectly with the events themselves. Skipping down again. France received no exceptional treatment from Hitler and fascism. A general plan coordinated the activity of the Fifth Columns all over the world. All were recruited from the same circles and had the same social and political composition. The object was the same everywhere, to divide and unnerve public opinion, weaken the resistance of the regime, and prepare a governmental group ready to execute a fascist coup d'etat at a moment of trouble or confusion. The methods were the same everywhere. Cultivation of the seeds of disunity which normally exist among free men and in free countries, exaggeration and inflammation of all racial and religious conflicts, all class rivalries, all political antagonisms, gradual conversion of opposition and dissent into hate, creation of an atmosphere of civil war. The means used were the same everywhere. Campaigns of calumny against the democratic leaders capable of opposing fascism, Blum in France, Roosevelt in the United States, the development of anti-Semitism, because anti-Semitism is the first manifestation of racism and contains in petto the whole doctrine of Hitler, use of the fear of communism among the middle classes, because anti-communism is the best way to prevent the union of all anti-fascist forces. This last device has been the most efficacious. The fear of communism has become, in Europe and American politics of recent years, a much more important factor than communism itself.
That again from For the Record, 951, Fascism, 2017 World Tour.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
We're going to return to the present in France, and we're going to look at how Marine Le Pen's National Front is a direct extension, a continuation of the French fascism of which L'Action Française and Charles Maurras were part. Shortly before the first round of the election, Marine Le Pen made an interesting comment from the New York Times of April 11th of 2017. We find the following story, this by Adam Nossiter, N-O-S-S-I-T-E-R. Le Pen redirects blame in 42 roundup of Jews. A casual remark about France's wartime anti-Jewish actions by Marine Le Pen, the leader of the far-right National Front, threatened on Monday to derail her years-long effort aimed at, quote, undemonizing, unquote, her party, just as she is emerging as a strong contender in this month's presidential election. The remark was made on Sunday during an interview in which she referred to the most notorious roundup of Jews in France during World War II, when nearly 13,000 were arrested in Paris by the French police on July 16th and 17th, 1942, in what is known as the Ville d'Yves roundup. That's capital V-E-L, D apostrophe capital H-I-V. Quote, France wasn't responsible for the Ville d'Yves, she said. If there was responsibility, it is with those who were in power at the time. It is not with France. France has been mistreated in people's minds for years. Skipping down. It was the French government's police chief, René Ariany Bousquet, B-O-U-S-Q-U-E-T, a favorite head of the government at the time, who organized the roundup, impressing his German counterparts with his energy. Skipping down. Ex-wartime Nazi collaborators were prominent in the early leadership of the National Front in the 1970s, including members of the French SS and collaborationist Milice, that's M-I-L-I-C-E, and even a leading official of the French wartime anti-Jewish agency, a minor cog in the Holocaust. A couple of points to note here. Note Marine Le Pen's exculpatory comments about the Ville d'Yves roundup, and note that René Bousquet, the French government's police chief, very close to Heinrich Himmler, by the way, the head of the SS, was responsible for that. We're going to come back to René Bousquet and his key role in post-war France in just a minute. Noting here, however, how the National Front, although it has, I wouldn't say cleaned itself up, but it has morphed from a more or less straight extension of the French and related German fascism of the 1930s and 1940s into an anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim party, euphemized as, quote, populist, unquote, in the world's mainstream media. More about the Nazi foundations of the National Front. This also from the New York Times of April 13th of 2017, also by Adam Nossiter, N-O-S-S-I-T-E-R. Le Pen's inner circle fuels doubts about bid to, quote, undemonize, unquote, her party. Speaking about some of her aides, Frédéric Chatillon, C-H-I-T-I-L-L-O-N, and Axel Lustau, L-O-U-S-T-A-U. They have remained national socialists, said Émeric Chauprade, C-H-A-U-P-R-A-D-E, once Ms. Le Pen's principal advisor on foreign affairs until a falling out, partly over his pro-Israel stance. Separately, an affidavit filed in a 2014 defamation lawsuit, later dropped, offered a fuller portrait of Mr. Chatillon's extremist views from that era. In the affidavit, Denis Lemoel, once a member of GUD, Groupe Union Défense, a far-right student group, described Mr. Chatillon's nostalgia for the Third Reich and his closeness to Holocaust deniers. Mr. Lemoel told of a 1993 rally Mr. Chatillon organized for the student group in Paris that resounded with Sieg Heils and Nazi salutes. During that period every year, Frédéric Chatillon organized a dinner on the birthday of the Führer, April 20th, to pay homage to this great man, the affidavit states. The only debatable point is the use of the term neo-Nazi. The wrongful qualifier neo, the affidavit states. French television recently broadcast video from the 1990s of Mr. Lustau visiting an aging, prominent former SS member, Léon Degrelle, D-E-G-R-E-L-L-E, a decorated warrior for Hitler and the founder of the Belgian Rex Party, a pre-war fascist movement. Other videos showed Mr. Chatillon speaking warmly of his own visit with Mr. Degrelle, who was a patron saint of Europe's far-right youth until his death in 1994. I would note that Degrelle was also a leader of the post-World War II Odessa SS Underground. Now, note the name René Bousquet, again the leader of the Veldiv Roundup. He was very close to François Mitterrand, the French socialist president and the leading French leftist politician. And François Mitterrand is no stranger to the French far right. From the Wikipedia entry, Mitterrand and the far right. Note here Mitterrand's links with the French fascist underground that you heard described in Triumph of Treason, again authored in 1944 by Pierre Coe, and note the Croix de Feu and the Cagoule. Speaking of Mitterrand on the far right, an example is his membership of the Volontaires Nationaux, National Volunteers, an organization related to François de la Roque's far-right league, the Croix de Feu, for 1 to 3 years, depending on the source. On February 1, 1935, Mitterrand joined the Action Française March. That is something organized by Charles Marat, beloved to Steve Bannon, beginning again. On February 1, 1935, Mitterrand joined the Action Française March, more commonly known as l'Invasion Metec, to demonstrate against foreign doctors setting up in France with cries of La France aux Français, very reminiscent of what the National Front is doing today. There are two photos that show Mitterrand facing a police line published in Les Camelots du Roi by Maurice Pujol. Mitterrand admitted being there, but he denied taking part in the demonstration in a TV interview with Jean-Pierre Eichenbach in September of 1944, skipping down. Many young people, mostly students, lived at 104 Rue de Vaugirard, Paris, with the Père Mariste, and they all knew the leaders of La Cagoule, a right-wing terrorist organization. And skipping down about Mitterrand. During the winter of 1936, François Mitterrand took part in action against Gaston Jézé. between January and March of 1936, the nationalist right and the Action Française campaigned for Zez's resignation because he acted as a counselor for Haile Selassie I of Ethiopia after he was driven from Addis Ababa by Mussolini's troops during the Second Italo-Abyssinian War. Skipping down. The most damning of all charges against Mitterrand and his right-wing connections is probably his long-lasting friendship with René Bousquet, ex-Secretary General of the Vichy Police. Charles de Gaulle said of Mitterrand and Bousquet, "They are ghosts who come from the deepest depths of the collaboration," unquote. Georges-Marc Benamou, B-E-N-A-M-O-U, quotes Mitterrand as saying of Bousquet, quote, "His career shattered at the age of 35. It was dreadful." Note the following. Now, René Bousquet is the guy who organized the Vendive Roundup. We have his Wikipedia page. He was very close in the written description for the show. René Bousquet was very close to Heinrich Himmler, who was impressed, as the New York Times noted, with his energy. Of the René Bousquet and Mitterrand relationship, in 1974, René Bousquet gave financial help to François Mitterrand for his presidential campaign against Valéry Giscard d'Estaing. In an interview with Pierre Favier et Michel Martin-Rodin, Mitterrand claimed that he was not the only left-wing politician to benefit from Bousquet's money, as René Bousquet helped finance all the principal left-wing politicians from the 1950s to the beginning of the 1970s, including Pierre Mendès France. We're still after Mitterrand's 1981 win. René Bousquet was received at the Élysée Palace to talk politics. Some note that René Bousquet helped to finance not only François Mitterrand's career, but also that of those of other French left-wing politicians. We're going to come back to this, and for the record, 957, but for some background about the cagoule and attempts to overthrow the French government, many of these conspirators described here became part of the Vichy Fifth Column that you heard described in the excerpt from Triumph of Treason by Pierre Coe. This is from Miscellaneous Archive Show M61, recorded in September of 1994, and in turn we're reading from the book Armies of Spies by Joseph Gollum, G-O-L-L-O-M-B, published in hardcover by Macmillan in 1939.
Returning once again to Armies of Spies by Joseph Gollum from 1939. Gollum writes, "Fascism was rearing its head in France under the leadership of Colonel Casimir de la Roque," that's R-O-C-D-E-L-A, capital R-O-C-Q-U-E, "who was openly aping Hitler and Mussolini. Rallying against the threat to their democracy, the people of France, from communists to the solidly middle-class radical socialists, formed the Front Populaire, went to the polls, and elected a potent majority united under Léon Blum, who became premier. The victory rendered desperate and ruthless the big industrialists and the, quote, 200 families, unquote, of France, who owned the bulk of France's wealth." So note again that in France there was a situation where the wealth of the nation was concentrated to a large extent, primarily in the hands of 200 families. Those 200 families represented the core of the sentiment on behalf of fascism, that sentiment expressing itself not only in the Cagoulard movement, the clandestine organization for a fascist coup in 37 and 38, but the later Vichy collaboration. What we're going to look at next is Joseph Gollum's description of the fascist agitation and of the clandestine coup attempt that was staged by the Cagoulard, the so-called Hooded Ones. Again, they were a clandestine French fascist organization that relied on small, highly organized clandestine groups, heavily armed, as we shall see, as their basic methodological foundation. The Cagoule's activities came to light in 1937 and 38 when the French police authorities staged a series of raids and came across all sorts of weapons caches, secret hideouts, secret fortresses, and they came upon these while investigating bombings and assassinations that had been performed by members of the Cagoule. Now, again, what we're looking at here, and bear in mind François Mitterrand's connections to the Cagoule and to the Cagoular leaders, what we're looking at here is a coup attempt, very similar to the American fascist coup attempt of 1934, in which dissatisfied French industrialists, financiers, politicians, and national security people, meaning military officers, military leaders, attempted to overthrow the democratically elected government of Léon Blum because they were more sympathetic. They preferred fascism to democracy. Later, many of these same elements actively collaborated with the German invasion. And as we shall see, the Cagoule was basically allied with Hitler and Mussolini and represented a fifth column, an actual projection into France of the Third Reich's intelligence services and also the Italian intelligence services for the purposes of subverting their neighbor nation. And note the profound, note the pivotal role played by the domestic fascists, in this case the Cagoule, the Cagoulard, in this subversion effort by by Italy and Germany. The description of the Cagoule, and by the way, the Cagoule, La Cagoule was the organization, the Cagoulard were the members of that organization. In describing the Cagoulard fascist coup attempt of 1937 and 38, Joseph Gollum writes as follows. The witch's cauldron of blood and dynamite was still simmering when on October 16th, a new melodrama began on National Highway No. 5 that runs from Geneva to Paris. Two Swiss customs officers were patrolling that road at Curet, C-U-R-E-T, when from around the bend came a black coupe converted into a commercial vehicle. The car swerved into the curve so fast that one of the rear doors flew open and then in the straightaway it closed again. When the customs officer came to this curve, they saw a trail of rifle cartridges in the road. By this time, the car was well into French territory and the customs officers, telephoned ahead. At a filling station, the coupe was stopped by French police and searched. It was full of ammunition for small arms. The driver and only occupant was taken to police headquarters for questioning. He gave his name readily, Fernand Jacoubiez, J-A-K-U-B-I-E-Z, or Jacoubier. It took pressure, however, to make him answer more searching questions. Quote, where are you taking all that ammunition? Unquote. To the Villa La Futé in Rueil, R-U-E-I-L, a suburb of Paris, he finally replied. Jacoubier was not allowed to send out word of his arrest, and the Sûreté Nationale converged on the Via La Futé. The house was owned by a Lucien Lenoir, L-E-N-O-I-R, but the man who lived in it called himself Louis-Joseph Malicon, M-A-L-L-I-C-O-N-E. The tenant looked profoundly disturbed when plainclothes men swarmed into La Futé, but he protested they would find nothing in the house to warrant, quote, outrageous intrusion, unquote. Two of the intruders kept him company in the living room. The rest explored the house from garret to cellar. Down below, at the end of a narrow hallway, they came to a wall of shelves of bottled wine. They probed about and found a hidden door, which they opened. Their flashlights revealed a large square chamber with walls of reinforced concrete, to which were fastened iron rings and strong chains, obviously a prison. In the wall opposite the entrance was another door with a peephole. This door had to be pried open with steel. It was made of metal, but finally gave way. The room into which it opened was much longer than the other and was lined with rows of cots. At first, the searchers thought it was a dormitory, then that it was intended as an infirmary. There were glass cabinets full of surgical instruments, medical supplies, and, incongruous in a sick room, racks of loaded revolvers. The landlord and the caretaker of the villa stubbornly denied that they knew anything about these rooms. The police tried another tack. Those interesting rooms, they decided, with their massive, specially constructed walls of reinforced concrete, were not built by some inexperienced provincial mason. A swift nationwide hunt found André Vasselin, V-A-S-S-E-L-I-N, of 13 Rue Bettencourt at Dieppe, who admitted he had worked on the masonry job at La Futé. He, too, was questioned, and this time to some effect. It was my boss, Monsieur Ansaux, A-N-C-A-U-X, who ordered me to do that work, unquote. Anceau was arrested. His business, that of a building contractor, proved no clue to his interest in the Villa Via Lafute, but his political affiliation was more illuminating. He was a former leader of the local chapter of Colonel de la Roque's fascist organ, Croix de Feu, that's Cross of Fire. Again, that's one of the two dominant fascist organizations in France, along with the Cagoule, a considerable degree of overlap between them. Continuing, his home and office were searched, and bills for reinforced concrete were scrutinized with addresses where the material was to be delivered. At 64 Rue Ampère, Paris, a Monsieur Robert de la Motte Saint-Pierre had installed what he advertised as a, quote, center of healing, unquote, by suggestion, hypnotism, and the like. Suddenly, a group of men who seemed to be in no mood to be healed of anything invaded the healing center. They broke into the cellar, and Monsieur de la Motte Saint-Pierre had to explain what healing had to do with 24 modern machine guns of German make, which they found there. There was also what he called his garage in the same block. Here, the persistent visitors found walls of reinforced concrete, which, together with the openings in them, suggested a machine gun blockhouse more than a garage. At 37 Rue Ribera, Paris, there was a boarding house for unmistakably genteel elderly ladies. The rooms were furnished in the Baroque style of the period when the boarders there were young. The one strange note in the decoration was a heavily hooded male figure that was repeated as a sort of leitmotif throughout the house. Obviously, it meant something to the present proprietor, for it had been only recently introduced in the decoration. Later, it developed that it was the insignia of the Order of the Cagoulard, or Hooded Ones. When police tried to explore the cellar of the boarding house, they had to smash through a bricked-up door and found themselves inside a subterranean fortress. It was full to the roof with crates containing cartridges for all kinds of firearms, from revolvers to machine guns. Important to the use of this place seemed to be a telephone and a radio transmitter, indicating that this was a storehouse subject to calls by telephone or shortwave radio. The Sûreté was accumulating addresses, and every visit yielded results. At the home of Monsieur and Madame Juchereau, J-U-C-H-E-R-E-A-U, whose lives seemed to be impeccable with middle-class respectability, the cellar was found to contain 400 hand grenades, 378 explosive cartridges, and 100,000 cartridges of calibers ranging from 13 millimeter. There were also revolvers, rifles, and 16 submachine guns, products of Italian and German armament makers Beretta and Schmeisser. What the police found most interesting here were two bombs of the same models as those which blew up the buildings in Rue de Presbourg and Rue de Boissier. On the 18th of November, police visited the shop of an antique dealer, Monsieur Mauler, M-A-U-L-E-R, in Rue Rotreau near the Odéon, a quarter mellow with bookshops and little art shops. Mollet's neighbors were accustomed to see wooden cases of all sizes and shapes delivered at the shop. They assumed they contained ancient sculpture, coppers and brasses of the Far East, Chinese and Japanese antiques in which Monsieur Mollet seemed specially interested. The neighborhood was shocked, therefore, to see police descend on the antique shop with scant ceremony. There proved to be several cellars, one under the other. The police disturbed the dust-laden treasure house of antiquity and found rooms full of stock more utilitarian than ornamental. Specifically, they listed cases of cartridges and Schmeisser machine guns. By the way, I thought that was Schmeisser, S-C-H-M-E-I-S-S-E-R. I may be wrong. It's spelled here as Schmesser, S-C-H-M-E-S-S-E-R. I don't know whether Golem is right or whether I'm correct in my memory. But in any case, it's a small point. Continuing. In addition, there were new uniforms enough to clothe whole companies of infantry. Monsieur Mollet and his sister were arrested. The lawyer they called, Monsieur Xavier Vallat, V-A-L-L-A-T, was a member of the Croix de Feu and a friend of Duke Pozzo di Borgio. A close associate of his was Jacques Doriot, head of the French Popular Party, which has as its program a frankly fascist rule for France and collaboration with Hitler. Other arsenals were uncovered in Paris, Caen, and Lyon. The whole map of France became dotted with such finds. Newspapers were read now by the French as though they were bulletins from a hospital where an exploratory operation was going on. On November 21st, Colonel de la Roque, leader, issued a public statement to his followers of the Croix de Feu. Quote, "Prepare to be accused of storing arms and to be arrested. It seems to be the mode," unquote. Ostensibly, the tone was bitter complaint. Many, however, read it as a warning, quote, "get rid of armament," unquote. And immediately after his statement, a new development rendered France almost hysterical. The papers now began to record stores of arms and ammunition no longer in hiding places, but hastily thrown out on highways, streets, in fields, in brooks. Cases of cartridges were found in the middle of a street in Lyon, packages of dynamite in a ditch at Valenciennes, label cartridges on the Montreux-en-Caux highway, an enormous arsenal in an abandoned quarry at Annay-sur-Marne. Children came home showing off neat, heavy boxes they had found somewhere. Parents became frantic, for the packages were crammed with explosives. Newspapers warned everybody not to touch strange finds. On January 26, 1937, the warning received grim confirmation. At Via Juif, police were carting away 6,000 grenades and 200 kilograms of explosives they had found in a Cagoulard arsenal. A policeman let slip his end of a wooden case. The ammunition blew up and took a toll of 14 lives. All France was asking, quote, "who is behind all this," unquote. A partial answer came on November 23rd. For the first time, the government made public the name of an organization with which the hidden arsenals were linked. It was the Comité Secret d'Action Révolutionnaire. At once, its first letters, CSAR, made a word on everybody's lips. Interchangeable with it was Cagoulard, quote-unquote, after a report that at the meetings of this organization, members wore monk's cowls to hide their faces. Of course, this is one of the fascist organizations that François Mitterrand was very close to. Continuing, up to then, it was obvious that those arrested were only small fry in a big conspiracy. Then, on the same day that CSAR became a byword, the police announced the arrest of Monsieur Eugène Deloncle, D-E-L-O-N-C-L-E. That said something. He was a big industrialist, member of the Chamber of Commerce of Paris, formerly an engineer at the Penway Works, and head of the Maritime and River Transport Mortgage Company. The police charged that under the alias of Grosset, G-R-O-S-S-E-T, he was also one of the leaders of the Cagoulard. The accusation was so serious that it was made public by Monsieur Max Dormoy, D-O-R-M-O-Y, head of the Ministry of the Interior. Quote, "Investigations on the part of the Sûreté Nationale and the Prefecture of Police in the course of the last few weeks have uncovered a widespread plot against the republican institutions of our country. Stores of military material have been seized, most of it manufactured in other countries. Magazines, rifles, and machine guns, revolvers, hand grenades, cartridges, explosives in bulk, uniforms in quantity, war medical equipment, and the like have been found in hiding places all over France." Quote, "A search of the main office of the Maritime and River Transport Mortgage Company, 78 Rue de Provence, the head of which, Eugène Deloncle, consulting engineer of the Penway Works, established the fact that there is in existence a secret, semi-military organization basing itself on force, that it consists of a general staff, espionage bureau, and a medical corps. The formation of its members into divisions, brigades, regiments, battalions, etc., shows indubitably the military character of this organization. Documents seized on the premises reveal that the objective of this organization is to substitute a regime of dictatorship in place of the republican form and the republican form of our government. In addition to the above material found, there are also blank papers obviously intended for the manufacture of false passports, plans for the transport of armed troops, detailed information on the personnel and organization of the police departments of our principal cities, notepaper, and other stationery stolen from military establishments in our government, lists of buildings that have several exits and entrances, a detailed map of the sewers of Paris with indications how the Chamber of Deputies can be reached through them, plans of the interior of newspaper offices, facsimiles of the signatures of important ministers of our government, a list of high functionaries and parliamentarians to be arrested at a given signal, plans for the seizure of municipal buses and other means of city transport, plans for stealing arms and munitions from the arsenal at Mont Valérien." So again, the Cagoulard, again, this clandestine fascist organization whose members reportedly wore hoods, and were organized, again, in an underground cellular fashion. The Cagoulards were actually attempting to overthrow the Popular Front of Léon Blum, the democratically elected government of France, and to replace it with a fascist dictatorship. And this Cagoulard program of 37 and 38 was very similar to the American coup attempt of 1934 that I discussed in Radio Free America program number 10.
That began from Miscellaneous Archive Show M61, recorded in September of 1994. And the book again, From Armies of Spies by Joseph Gollum, published in hardcover by Macmillan in 1939. And available, by the way, for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. We will come back to discussion of François Mitterrand and René Bousquet, the organizer of the Veldive Roundup, and the French fifth column that you heard described there. By the way, note that one of the things that impelled the French electorate in the direction of the Popular Front of Léon Blum was economic concentration and the resulting social dislocation in France, something to which we are no strangers here in the U.S. More about all of this, however, next week. This concludes For the Record program number 956, The National Front and French Deep Politics, Part 1, being recorded on April 27th of the year 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.